afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the June 2016 conference call at the Harbor Group of RBC Dominion Securities. My name is Chris Newell, and I'm joined by our lead strategist, Robin Gullison, and today we're going to address a number of topics with a focus on the equity markets both in Canada and the United States. As in previous times, we're going to do this in a question and answer format where Robin will address both the slides that are found on our website that you can access, as well as a number of common questions that our clients have been asking us over the course of the last month that Robin will field. So with that being said, we'll get right on with this. The first item on the agenda is to revisit the checklist that Robin put together earlier on in the year as markets were in a state of heightened volatility and the future was certainly unclear. Robin, could you revisit that checklist and let us know how things are progressing?
Absolutely. Thanks, Chris. And thank you to everybody on the call for taking time to join us today. So back in the late winter, early spring, when the markets were in a bit of turmoil, we put together a checklist of things we thought would be required to see better performance out of the equity markets. And we've had most of those to the good side. For example, we're looking for an improvement in the oil market. We've definitely seen that. I mean, crude oil has almost doubled off its low from 26 to a little over $50 today. Wanted to see a better tone to credit markets. High-yield bonds have hit their high of the year this week, so we've seen a check mark there as well. Better economic data, despite what was a weak non-farm payrolls release in the U.S. last week, on average, the economic data has continued to come through positively. We're looking for better growth this quarter than we saw last quarter in the U.S. Canada, of course, is going to be negatively affected by the wildfires, and that's obviously a one-off, and you'll definitely see some sort of bounce back on the rebuild from those wildfires. Point number four is looking for better technical indicators. That was looking for the market to hold its lows and rebound from there. That's what we've seen, and now we're sitting near all-time highs in the U.S. market. And lastly, we want to see some clarity on the U.S. election, and I guess just even in the last 24, 48 hours, we've gotten a little bit more clarity as Ms. Clinton now seems to be the presumptive nominee for the Democratic Party, and I think most people would expect her to win the election, but as we've seen with Mr. Trump so far, it's been very difficult to count him out, so not quite there yet, but we're definitely getting clarity as to who the two main combatants are going to be. So I think the big story there was that we saw a lot of volatility, a lot of massive swings in investor sentiment, which is what drives the market in the short term. And aside from the oil market, the underlying fundamentals of the economy didn't really change that much. It was mostly a big move in sentiment. That has definitely improved now, though I'd say sentiment out there is still fairly skeptical, and that's allowed the market to keep kind of climbing the proverbial wall of worry.
Thanks very much, Robin. The second point that we wanted to address was volatility. And generally speaking, investors tend to be pretty fine with the upward volatility. It's the downward volatility that really gets people's attention. You made some bold calls earlier on in the year. February 16th was one of the last conference calls where you dug your heels in and said that this was a correction within the context of a bull market and that we really shouldn't be losing our nerves. What's changed since then? Do you have the same opinion?
Yeah, I do have the same opinion that we're still in what's been a long-term bull market. Obviously, the valuation has changed a bit since February because the market has had a nice bounce back. If you look at page three of the slide deck, if you have it in front of you, it shows the TSX for the last 5 years. And in the short term, tons of volatility. You can see that the TSX corrected by 24% from the highs of 2014 to the lows in 2016. Since then, we've had a 19 to 20% rally off those lows. And you're actually at a point when the market was at its lows. The TSX had gone nowhere for a decade. Now, luckily, most of our clients' portfolios don't look anything like the TSX because it's been massively overweight oil and gas and materials compared to what a prudent portfolio stance would have. And that, of course, has led the TSX to be one of the best performers in the world this year. The TSX is actually the top-performing developed market this year. And I think a lot of people ask the question, well, if the TSX is up so much, why isn't my portfolio up as much? There's a couple of reasons for that. Number one, most of our portfolios didn't go down as much as the TSX last year. And secondly, we have some foreign exposure, which has actually been a big help over the last 5 years. It's just turned into a bit of a headwind this year with the currency and with the TSX bouncing up what were depressed levels. And to, to have been in at the bottom, you would have had to live through that 24% correction to get the 20% bounce back. And I think a lot of people probably prefer a bit of a smoother profile to their returns.
Terrific. I was going to ask what was driving the TSX this year, but you seem to have already answered this. And You know, maybe just to give us some perspective, you know, we've all really been focusing on the short term over the course of the last several months. Give us a lens into what the long term looks like and how should we be thinking about the Canadian stock market?
Well, when I look at the long term, I think you have to look at what your long term returns have been like, what they're likely to be like, and what your alternatives are. And in a world where cash is paying something between 0 and 1%, and even a 30-year government bond in Canada pays under 2%. And just for interest's sake, if you're in Germany, the 10-year German bond touched 0.035% today. That's right, almost zero for 10 years. If you're looking for any sort of income from a portfolio, people have little choice but to explore the equity market. And when you have a long-term return profile that we think still sits in that kind of mid to high single-digit range, if you assume you're going to get 5 to 7% earnings growth and tack on a dividend of 2 to 3, that compares quite well to even the longest-term government bonds. We still think it makes sense to have equity exposure. You know, we're obviously always going to have that safety component of the portfolio and cash and government bonds, but those are no longer a source of return. They're a source of safety in times of panic, but they aren't going to provide much in the way of return. You know, I did some numbers a couple of months ago for one of our publications, and I think I ran the numbers, and if you were just to assume that the stock market stayed still and you just received your dividends for the next 10 years in Canada, that the 10-year Canada bond would have to trade to a yield of negative 0.78% to have the same all-in return. So that would be that you'd get your 1.2% yield, but of course the dividend yield in the stock market is more than double that. So in order to get a capital gain from the bond to make up the rest of that return from just the dividends, assuming the market doesn't change and dividends don't grow, the yield would have to go to negative 78 basis points, which I guess anything's possible, but over a 10-year period, that seems rather unlikely. So for the long term, we still think it makes sense to live through that short-term volatility to get what has historically been a superior return, what we think will be a superior return going forward.
I guess the next question that we would ask, talking about superior performance, is, you know, we've now seen the S&P 500, if we turn our sights to the U.S. market, trade sideways for a couple of years, and we're several years into the market expansion after the 2008-2009 financial crisis. Looking at statistical averages, you know, what's normal at this point in the cycle? What should we be expecting?
Well, if you shift to page 5, there's some actually pretty fascinating studies here done by our U.S. strategist, Jonathan Golub. And what he does here, it's a bit of a busy chart, but the real story is looking at the averages of each of those chunks of graphs. And what he does is looks at the early cycle, so the first year of an expansion. He looks at the middle years, the last year, and then during the recession, and what the average returns for the U.S. market look like. So no real surprise, in the first year of the cycle, you have the strongest returns, averaging 37.9% going back to cycles beginning in 1982. Mid-cycle, average return is about 18.4%. Again, that may seem kind of high, but that's what the historical average has been during bull markets. And then on the far right-hand side, during the recession, again, no surprise, pretty nasty, at negative 39.8% average return. What I found surprising was the third set of bars showing the late cycle, so the final year of a bull market, the average return is still 20%. I think intuitively I would have thought it would be lower because as you get near the end of the cycle, you think things would taper off. But I guess this just shows that bull markets tend to end with a bang and not a whimper. And it shows that there's, you know, you're leaving significant upside on the table in selling too early, you know, unless we think a recession is quite near.
Interesting. Thanks very much. Robin, you recently did some work. And when I look at page number 6 of your slide presentation, we see the output of that work on timing the market. And to the layperson, when they look at this chart, it's a little bit confusing. They might immediately glaze on to the next one. Could you give us an explanation of what your studies found regarding individual investors and the way in which they time the market?
Absolutely, and you're right. The numbers here, there's a lot of numbers on here, and it's easy to glaze over them, but I think it's actually really important. So what the numbers show here is it takes a look at the S&P 500 ETF. So this is the biggest ETF in the world. The first column across, or line across, pardon me, shows the buy and hold return for each calendar year going back the last 10 years. So it's simply just the total return of that ETF if somebody bought it January 1st and sold it December 31st of that year. The second line shows what they call the dollar-weighted investor return. So in this study, what they did is looked at all the inflows and outflows from the ETF, when the average person bought, when the average person sold, and they got an approximation for what the average investor's experience was in that same ETF. The third line is the difference in return, and you can see in every single year, that the dollar-weighted investor return, so the proxy for the typical investor's return, underperformed the buy-and-hold return of that index by over 3 percentage points on average. And over a long time, you know, that makes up a huge difference in total return. So this tells us that on average, investors tend to buy high and sell low against all their, you know, trying to do the best at all times. The emotion takes over, and people tend to buy when they get excited when the market's high and sell when it's low. And over the long term, that can make a big difference in returns. Now, it doesn't mean that buy and hold is the only answer. Obviously, if a recession seems imminent, you want to reduce equity exposure and amp up your protective elements of the portfolio. But it does argue for holding on through the corrections. We've done a lot of work and talked a lot on these calls about corrections and how people should prepare for them. And again, unless it's going to be a nasty bear market, you know, I saw a good quote from the famous investor Peter Lynch the other day. He said, you know, more money has been lost anticipating corrections, trying to protect against corrections, than has ever been lost in corrections in the market. I think that's a pretty apt quote, and I think the data here shows that to be true, in that it's hard to stay in when you have these short-term corrections in the market. But unless you're staring at a really significant bear market, it makes sense to hold on.
Terrific. Thanks very much, Robin. And turning, you know, staying with the U.S. market, if we turn to your slide number 8, where you have it labeled potential for further upside on a breakout, can you first describe for us what a breakout is and what the point is that you're trying to make from this chart? You know, as again, to a layperson, you know, simplistically, the U.S. market has gone sideways for 2 years with lots of opportunity to blink and lose money. What's the point you're trying to make here?
So what I'm trying to show here, you know, we talked earlier about technical analysis, which is one of the tools we use to help with our asset allocation and our market timing. And one of the things you see in technical analysis is they talk about when stocks trade in a range. So I've got a box here on the chart that shows the S&P 500 has been in this kind of 1,800 to 2,100 range for about 2 years. And typically what happens is if you do break out from that range to the upside, so if the market goes to a new high, the way the technicians will look at this, they'll do what they call a measured move. So if you break from the range, it creates a new technical pattern, and they surmise that the move to the upside is equivalent to the size of the range. So therefore, if this range is 300 points, and we break through to the upside and it holds on and continues, they would expect the market to rise 300 points. You know, timeline to be determined, obviously. They're not going to give you both the magnitude and the time, but the measured move is typically the same size as the range. So if we were to break through and that theory were to hold, that would put the market up about 300 points, around 2,400, which would be 14% higher from here. So that's kind of where they see upside to in the market over the next few years if we break through to that upside.
And just staying with that theme, you know, maybe talk about the valuation of the market. You know, I believe that we're trading at somewhere in the neighborhood of 17.5 times earnings for the S&P 500. If we were to break out, as you suggest, and move another 14 or 15% higher from here, wouldn't that make these markets awfully expensive? Is it justified, or is the market perhaps seeing something that we're not factoring in?
I think if you were to break up to the upside definitively and have a strong move, as would be suggested by the technicals, is that either you're receiving some news, incremental positive news, or the market's starting to price it in. So what could that be? Well, number one, you could just have earnings estimates go up. So we've been stuck at this kind of $120 to $125 a share earnings estimate for the S&P 500. For next year, analysts are penciling in 130 to 133. So right now, on the current 12-month forward earnings estimate of about $125, the market is, as you suggested, about 17 times earnings. If you were to take an earnings estimate of 130, which isn't that much higher, that's a typical year's earnings growth, you'd be down to 16 times. And if you were to have, say, oil become stronger from here and oil companies stop being a drag on earnings, industrial companies start to see stronger earnings, that sort of thing, if that earnings multiple, pardon me, that earnings estimate were to go higher to, say, 135, all of a sudden, you know, trading another 100, 200 points higher, it doesn't change the PE all that much if the earnings change to the same degree. Our big theory for the last couple of years has been we're not going to rely on multiple expansion to drive the market. We're going to rely on earnings, and that would fit that thesis. The kind of X factor here is what's going on with the central banks. The U.S. seems like they're pretty determined to raise interest rates, albeit very, very slowly, but it's a different story in Europe and Japan. I think they've kind of learned their lesson with negative interest rates. So, you know, not a lot of people would have noticed this, but a few months ago, the Bank of Japan went to negative interest rates, and they got the exact opposite reaction. So when, you know, they thought they'd have their currency devalue and the stock market go up, they had the exact opposite. Their currency strengthened, and the stock market went down. They probably don't want to make that mistake again. So there is a view out there from some, you know, serious analysts who think that one of the steps in the future might be for the Europeans or the Japanese to actually do QE for stocks, so print money to buy stocks. Now, we can all debate whether that's a good idea long term, but if that were to happen, I think that would be a catalyst for multiple expansion because you would have this massive buyer entering the stock market that wasn't there before. So that would be your catalyst to get this breakout without earnings changing materially.
Terrific. And sticking with the theme of interest rates that you talked about, could we perhaps turn to page number 14, which is some new material that we haven't covered off over the course of the last monthly call or so, and look at the preferred share market in Canada. And I know that for a lot of investors, this has been a real disappointment. Last year, we saw losses. This year, we've seen a little bit of a gain off the bottom, but certainly not keeping pace with the equity market. Is there anything that we should be taking stock of here? Are there any reasons to be optimistic on this asset class?
Yeah, so we did a call focusing on fixed income, in particular on preferred shares, a couple of months ago. And if you look at the return year to date for the rate reset index, I think it's down about 4% year to date. If you look at it from the lows near March 1st, the preferred share universe is up about 13%, and the resets are up over 15%. So it's still a challenge year to date, but a significant improvement off the lows. And the things that have driven that are some of the things we're looking for. Number one is higher interest rates. We've seen bouts of higher interest rates in Canada. You know, we've seen the five-year yield go from 50 basis points to 1%. Now it's back down around 0.6. I think as long as it doesn't drop to new lows, the market can handle that. So that's, you know, we'd love to see them go higher because we think that's what's going to drive the next phase for this market. But as it stands, not breaking to new lows is a positive. We've seen stable and narrowing corporate bond spreads. So I talked about the high yield bond index hitting its highs for the year. That's a proxy for what's happening in the credit markets. That's been a positive. And the big one, I think, has been the strong performance of new issues. So we saw a vicious cycle over the last couple of years where new issues kept coming to market on better terms, and it hurt all of the rest of the existing market, which was kept feeding upon itself. This year, we've finally seen that trend broken. We've seen a bunch of new issues from the banks and bigger companies like TransCanada that have come at very generous yields for the investors, and they've traded up almost immediately to say, a dollar premium on a $25 par preferred. And for the first time in years now, we actually saw an issuer come at a lower dividend than they came before. And that, to me, was kind of the next inflection point. And it also sold very well. So if investors are willing to buy preferred at a lower yield than they bought the last one, even though the underlying financial conditions haven't changed that much, that tells me demand is still there and you're seeing a sequential improvement. So I think that's been a big positive. To go from here, the market's stabled off in the last couple of months. It's been fairly flat. The next leg higher, we need to see those interest rates climb higher on the five-year Canada.
Thanks, Robin. The last question that I'll ask for today, and in the spirit of trying to keep these calls to 15 or 20 minutes, is to focus on the currency for a moment. And on a year-to-date basis, the two challenges that I guess individual investors have had, one would be preferred shares, and the second would be the currency. And I guess this is a glasses-half-full, glasses-half-empty scenario. On a glasses-half-full for domestic exposure, investors are wealthier with a rising Canadian dollar. On a glasses-half-empty scenario, it means that any foreign assets that they own are a little less valuable in Canadian terms. Can you talk about what our outlook is on the Canadian dollar and what are the drivers, as well as, you know, where do we see it going over the course of the balance of the year?
Sure. So the Canadian dollar has been extraordinarily volatile this year. I think that volatility is likely to taper off somewhat. I mean, we saw, as you can see, there's a chart on page 13 that shows the Canadian dollar with oil. You had a massive sell-off through the second half of 15 and into January this year, and then almost an equally large rally. That sort of volatility is fairly unprecedented. So I think it stables out somewhat going forward. It's going to be continued to be driven by oil and monetary policy. And I think if the U.S. Fed actually does raise interest rates, then you should see the Canadian dollar soften all else equal. There's a recent bout of strength in the Canadian dollar, partially due to oil, but a lot of it's due to the fact that we had that weak non-farm payrolls report, and it looks like the Fed's not going to raise rates in June, and even July is in question now. So a lot of it depends on what's going to happen to the Fed. I think the expectation for the Bank of Canada is that they're not going to do anything for quite a while. Therefore, the monetary policy piece of the puzzle all rests on what happens with the Federal Reserve in the U.S. If oil goes, you know, we're at $51 now, goes to 60, I think you can see the Canadian dollar trade higher, but it would be pretty surprising for me not to see some sort of consolidation or correction in this crude oil trade because it's been quite substantial just in the past few months here. So I think, you know, going further out the year, I think RBC's forecast is for a little more weakness in the Canadian dollar. That's based on a view that the Fed eventually raises interest rates, and I think I would agree with that. If the Fed actually can come through and raise interest rates, then you probably see this soften up a little bit from here. But without oil crashing back down to the 20s, I think we've probably seen the lows for the Canadian dollar this cycle.
Terrific. So perhaps, Robin, you could just summarize the key points that you made over the course of the presentation. A lot of material that we've covered. What are the key points that you want to leave us with?
I think the key points that I'd want to leave us with is, again, you know, the outlook is looking better than it was a few months ago. Sentiment is still fairly negative, so we do have the market continue to climb that wall of worry. In the short term, market is always volatile. There's always something happening that is worrying people, but as far as we're concerned, the long term still looks pretty good, and we think it's the way to go. Timing the market is definitely a challenge. You know, again, unless we're looking at a recession, it doesn't make sense to massively change asset allocation unless the facts change materially. Trying to tweak things too tightly around corrections tends to lose people money in the long term. The U.S. market is approaching new highs. If it actually can take those new highs and break out to the upside, we think there's further momentum to be had. Oftentimes, after you get these big moves, the reason for it's not known until it's in the past. So, again, it could be better earnings outlook, it could be stronger growth, or it could be some sort of monetary policy phenomenon. As far as the preferred share market goes, the outlook has looked better. The volatility has calmed down. I think there's actually a positive because having a market move with the kind of volatility that market had is not very healthy. So we think that market is actually starting to come back to health somewhat. And lastly, the Canadian dollar has been a huge impact on portfolios this year. I didn't answer your question about the impact on portfolios, but you know, we've had strength out of our Canadian securities, and to your point, the currency losses on the U.S. market have tended to offset that a bit. I think we have to keep in the context that over the past few years, that U.S. exposure has been absolutely massive for adding to performance. So giving some back, painful as it is kind of part and parcel of those of the territory. We still think it makes sense to have those foreign assets, not just for the currency diversification, but for the sector diversification that you just can't get in Canada that we've talked about many times.
Terrific. Well, thank you, everyone, for dialing in today, and we hope you find these calls of great use. And do please look for your email inbox for the invitation for the next month, which will be the first week of July, for our monthly conference call. And with that, we wish you a good day.